You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, The Retrievals is the newest production from the makers of the podcast Serial. It's been hovering near the top of the podcast charts since it came out. It follows the story of 200 IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, patients at the Yale Fertility Center, whose extreme and unusual pain during egg retrieval was dismissed by staff, only to find that one nurse had been replacing their fentanyl with saline. Now, the specifics of that case may be unusual, but many patients report to experiencing the story of their pain or other medical concerns being dismissed or overlooked by medical professionals, sometimes because of their gender, race, age, identity, or weight. Our next guest is an expert on patient-provider relationships, joining us for a look at the problem and advice on how to advocate for ourselves at the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this situation where your symptoms, maybe pain symptoms, weren't taken seriously enough? Maybe because you think of your gender, race, age, or weight? Have you had your medical concerns dismissed only to find out, yeah, there was something there all along? If you're a healthcare provider, how do you make sure you get the info you need from your patient, that you're on the same page? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Lutfi-Spencer is a professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Like to think this never happens, that communication is always great between doctors and patients' needs are taken seriously. Do we have a sense of how common it is that it doesn't work out the right way?
Well, we think it's pretty common. It happens with all these different groups that you're talking about. And certainly there's this growing online presence where people are talking about this term medical gaslighting. So that leads us to believe that people are really concerned about it.
Who is most vulnerable to this this medical gaslighting, to doctors and nurses maybe not hearing what they're saying?
Sure. Well, we definitely think women and people of color in particular, and also increasingly trans people and any combination therein. So if you're female and non-white, that's, you know, even sort of a double jeopardy situation.
What are some of the reasons behind that, do you think?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things going on. And some of them are at the level, of course, we have, you know, individual providers who maybe are kind of have racist or sexist tendencies, but there's a lot of smart, well-intentioned doctors out there trying to provide, you know, good healthcare, not do harm. So there's some things going on at the system level that kind of set us up for these problems and these biases. So for example, we have a long history in medicine of collecting data based on men and male animals and male cells. And we've kind of assumed for a long time, well, if it happens one way in men, it surely carries over to all these other populations. And what we're finding out is if something shows up in a way that is not the way it shows up in men, then that introduces a certain amount of uncertainty for doctors. And when there's uncertainty, it kind of invites people to fill in the gaps with stereotypes and bias.
Let's start with a couple of solutions to those problems. First of all, I think many of us have encountered that quick office visit. You know, it's not the doctor's fault. They've got another patient or multiple patients in waiting rooms right now. Would it help this situation just to add some kind of time to the doctor-patient interaction?
Oh, I think definitely, right? Doctors, it's just like us. If we go to the grocery store and you've got 400 things on your mind and you only have, you know, a short period of time to do your shopping, you're more likely to forget stuff. So I think if we kind of remember that doctors are in this system that puts a lot of pressures on them and it kind of invites, you know, problems in their decision making, it raises the question for us as patients, like, what can we do to make it go as straightforwardly as possible once we get to the doctor, right? And I think one of those things is have a list of questions in advance. You got to make sure if there's only 17 minutes on the table, you want that doctor to understand in minute one or two what your agenda is. Because if you're going in saying my knee hurts and they spend, you know, the first 10 minutes of the session talking about your blood pressure or something that was on their agenda, then you have sort of a missed opportunity to get what you want on the table.
Then with the issue of, you know, women presenting differently for certain conditions, I know strokes at an extreme level, heart problems might look different in women than men. There are different kinds of pain involved. what kind of training do we need out there for the medical profession to look at those things differently and not taking, as you mentioned, that research based all on men and trying to apply it to all women?
Sure. Well, at the national level, in terms of the National Institutes of Health funding research, they've started to really require that studies are diverse. You can't get away. You can't get $2 million anymore to do a study that's just all men. So that's good. And that's more diverse. That's pretty far upstream. But some of the things that I've seen in my research, for example, just taking the case of women getting missed for heart attacks, we would ask doctors, like, what do you think is going on with this patient? And they would say to me, this is just like this encyclopedia we learned in medical school. And I went and looked up the encyclopedia and like the angina entry. And there's a full page color illustration of a silver haired white man coming out of a restaurant into the blustery cold and the snow and clutching his chest. And I just think, well, why do we have to have a picture, an illustration of a man that they attach then to that idea of this is what a heart attack looks like? It's an old white man. When I think we could diversify those materials on that level too.
Talking to Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, looking at pain and other symptoms when we try to tell our doctors and nurses about them. Maybe not being heard, not being taken seriously, especially affecting women, people of color, and other groups. You could join in if you've been in this situation as a patient or a provider. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Karen, I want to talk about pain in particular, because in some ways it's a subjective experience. You can't plug in a painometer to measure pain. How can we make sure that we're communicating how pain is affecting us? And then on the other hand, how can providers make sure they're hearing that message about a patient's pain?
Sure. Pain is a really, you're right, it's very subjective. And so it's easy, it's open to being dismissed in these ways. And so, you know, some strategies for coming at this is maybe keeping a diary of your symptoms that you can share with a provider when you go in. So that gives them more detail maybe about when your pain happened, what you were doing before the pain got worse. That kind of goes hand in hand with making a list of questions in advance. I think also just sticking around and saying, like, I know my body and I know something is not right. I think there's more to this than what we just discussed today, or this is not normal for me. What else do you think might be going on?
And I want to talk now about people who are overweight or obese. Just reading up on this, anecdotally, a lot of reports of patients going in to see a doctor with a particular condition, having it immediately chalked up as related to weight and talking about diet and exercise. One extreme case, a patient coming in with abdominal pain, saying, oh, it's about your weight, and later finding out, no, it was actually a good-sized tumor that was causing this pain. Does obesity and overweight lead, in some cases, doctors to dismiss important symptoms?
There's definitely obesity stigma, and I think this is a growing area of concern and consideration and research, for sure. And again, it can be one of those things that's sort of a proxy. Like, I've had a doctor tell me, when I see someone who's overweight, I assume, and then they extrapolate from their weight to a whole bunch of other characteristics. Like, I assume they're not motivated. I assume they're not understanding what they need to do to maintain good health. So they can use this one piece of information as sort of a proxy for a bunch of other considerations.
Talking to Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, talking to her about how we can better advocate for ourselves if we feel like we're being dismissed at the doctor's office, and how to do healthcare a little better to try to prevent that happening in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in this situation where you feel a doctor, say, dismissed your pain or your other concerns? Have you found a provider that makes you feel heard? And if you work in medicine and healthcare, what factors make it difficult to build trust with your patients? Have you found ways to, you think, be a better listener? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado Denver, talking to her about what to do if you feel like our medical concerns or pain are not being taken seriously at the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how to advocate for yourself or maybe a loved one at the doctor's office? Do you have a story about a time you successfully spoke up, said, hey, I don't think I'm being heard. Here's what's going on. How did that work out? Do you have advice for other listeners struggling with this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. This just happened to me last week. My husband and I went to a specialist. He found out he had cancer. We were having to decide on a procedure or not. And when I asked a question, the doctor would not even acknowledge that I was there to begin with and pointed to me and said, it's not your choice, it's his choice. I've been married for 43 years, so it is my choice too. I don't know what to say to him tomorrow when we go back for a procedure. So.
Beth, thanks a lot for calling in. So sorry you're going through this. Karen, now, I know it's very common advice. You've mentioned it. When we're going in for something serious, bringing somebody like our spouse or someone else to help get, you know, make sure everything's heard, to help communicate. But in this case, Beth feels like as the person in that position, doctor doesn't seem to want to hear from her. What do you think?
That is a terrible story. I'm really sorry to hear that happen. So sometimes, especially like in a cancer center, you'll have a broader team of providers there. And so sometimes there's the oncologist, but there's also a social worker or other people who, nurse practitioners and people who are kind of, you know, a little bit more focused on some of the social aspects that go around cancer care. So I would definitely take a look at who else is in the team that you might be able to talk to there. And if not that, then I would also consider asking about a palliative care referral. And so palliative care is just intended to, people sometimes confuse it with hospice and they're not the same, but palliative care is designed to improve symptoms and pain management all the way through care. So it has nothing to do with end of life per se, but those people sometimes also have skills to help you work together as a team because you need to be treated as a team member in that situation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Beth. And best too, I hope you can find somebody you can communicate with there. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Speaking of teams though, Karen, Beth is doing the right thing being there with her husband in this case in a difficult situation. I know when I get really bad news, medical or otherwise, my memory is not necessarily going to be great. I'm not going to key in on some of the important stuff. Can you talk about the importance, the helpfulness of sometimes having that buddy there with you in the office, spouse or whoever, to help catch some of those details that you might miss as you're focused on the bad stuff?
For sure. I think it's excellent to have someone there with you, and it serves multiple purposes. So when, you know, when Beth goes home with her husband, you had another set of eyes and ears on the situation. And so you're providing moral support for each other, but you're also saying, did you hear that the same way I did? Did you understand that the same way I did? So if you're left with questions when you get home, that helps you formulate them. But also from the healthcare side, I think it sends a message that like, hey, look, he has someone at home who's really invested in how well he does. And they're paying attention and they're here and they are part of the team.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Pat with us in Sun Prairie. Pat, hi.
Yeah, I was saying that I went in for a Medicare exam, a physical exam for the year, and that's a real short exam. They sit you down, talk for a couple of minutes, and send you for a test. I don't really have anything wrong with me, so is that sort of a problem, you think, or not?
Pat, thanks for the call. I'm glad you're in good health, Karen, but that micro visit almost for a physical, are we just doing sort of an assembly line in some of these cases?
That's a really good question. And I think it speaks to like doctors have sort of sometimes or all providers, like they have sort of their own default agenda. They have their sort of checklist of things that they might want to get through in a physical or in an appointment. And they, again, like are in those short periods of time to work through a patient load. So that might be part of what you're seeing there, is that them just, they have a default agenda. And so if you, again, have agenda items that you want to be asking about or a health concern that you want covered, then that's a good thing to be vocal about.
Thanks again for that call. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've had a combination of things. I am elderly, and I was born severely premature at 27 weeks. And I've had problems all of my life. To make it short, I was laid on the right side of the incubator for 3 months, and therefore my left side was deprived of oxygen for 3 months. That extremely made all my muscles strained on my left side. My eye turned blind, and I now know the reason why. And I had 2 nutrition-related conditions, all of which I basically had to cure myself of. By stretching my muscles, my left eye was also turned out to the left.
Kay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry to hear about that. How does this play out when you go to see a doctor now? Do they even ask about some of that background when you come in with a problem?
They only ask you of whether you've had any kinds of everything they call a disease. They don't ask you what your basic body condition is. If you have one bone out of place and strained muscles, that can have a severe reaction in your body.
Okay, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, and sorry you've gone through all that. But Karen, Kay feeling like doctors need to dig more into some of her longer-term health history to understand what she might be presenting with today.
Sure. I think that's a completely fair concern. And again, like if you feel like that's something that the doctor needs to know about, and if you have 17 minutes to meet with them and it's going to take them 20 minutes to get to that part of your medical history, I would try to set them up for understanding where you're coming from as early as you can in that interaction.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Cheryl joins us now in Lake Geneva. Cheryl, hello.
Hi, how's you doing?
Are you there?
Yep, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. What did you want to tell us about, Cheryl?
Well, basically what it is, I've had breast cancer 3 times. And the last time I went in, I had found a lump, and I went in, and they were like, no, it's not a lump, but we can do an ultrasound if you want. And I said, well, yeah, I do want. And then they came back and she said, well, really, I couldn't see anything, so it's not. And I said, well, I think I should probably get another ultrasound then. So then they did an ultrasound where they took a smaller wand so they could see more of a local place, I guess. And then I went back and they were like, no, it's not. I've felt 10,000 cases over so many years of breast cancer, and it's not. And they could tell I was not happy with that. And I pushed for the MRI, and then sure enough, it was.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. Sorry you had to go through that, but she kept pushing, she says, Karen, and ultimately the MRI did find that, yes, she was right to worry about it. Is that a situation where maybe given a past history of breast cancer, doctors might have jumped on that a little sooner?
Well, definitely. And I think it's an example of, like, just listening to that story, it sounds kind of mentally exhausting.
Yes.
To keep pushing and pushing, right? But then she persisted, and you can see what the outcome is. And I think that's one of the things that's really tricky about it, because when you don't feel well, the last thing you want to do is have to fight with the healthcare system that's supposed to be there to help you. So that's one of the things I get out of that story, is the persistence that I admire. But it's difficult.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Karen, are there changes you'd like to see in our healthcare system that can help avoid situations like Cheryl's and the general concept of medical gaslighting that we started out with?
Yes, I think there's things that we've been talking about things that we can do as individuals, but I think as a society, you know, this issue of we need more diverse data, different kinds of people in our studies, so there's not so much uncertainty when an unusual case shows up in the doctor's office. Having more diverse workforce, most of our doctors are still men and still white men, and we have more diversity, but I think we could use a lot more. And then a lot of those things about how the healthcare system is set up, just we have doctors are dealing with conflicting incentives around how to get paid and liability and patient well-being, trying to balance a lot of things increasingly. And I think that sets us up for some of these problems.
Karen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. We talked to her about how we can better advocate for ourselves as patients if we feel like we're being dismissed at the doctor's office, plus some structural fixes to make sure that healthcare providers hear our symptoms and have some time to hear about our symptoms and take them seriously. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, to be American is to drink. To be American is to worry about drinking. Those are the opening lines of Zero Proof, a recipe book that traces the history of temperance in the United States and the recent rise of the non-alcoholic beverage. Our guest says the combination of drinking and socializing is woven into the fabric of our nation. But Americans are starting to renegotiate their relationship with alcohol, whether that means participating in Dry January, cutting back on alcoholic drinks throughout the week, or abstaining from it altogether. Today on Food Friday, we're celebrating the non-alcoholic drink with recipes and advice to help create NA cocktails at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you drink mocktails at a bar at home? What's your take on the rise of non-alcoholic drink options? Have you tried NA beers, or there's a lot of new spirits out there, even some wines alcohol-free? Join in at 800-642-1234. And have you been in that situation, maybe here in Wisconsin, where you're the only one not drinking? You feel like you're the odd one out? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elva Ramirez is a wine and spirits journalist. She's the author of the book Zero Proof, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. Elva, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Let's talk about the word we're using to talk about what we talk about. Mocktails. You know, people used to call them that. I say I make myself mocktails. A lot of people are moving away from that word, though, especially in the bartender world. Why is that?
You know, a lot of people don't know this, but according to Merriam-Webster, mocktail actually first shows up in the dictionary in 1916, which is a few years just before Prohibition. So it's been with us for that long. But when I was researching the book, I saw that when I looked at news databases, mocktail was around during Prohibition and certainly after, but people really start using it in the 1980s. When there was this move to curb drunk driving among teenagers. And so there were a lot of mocktail contests to encourage people to drink less. And that's where you start getting the popularity of mocktails. And that's actually where it gets its terrible reputation, because bartenders at the time had lost touch with the elegance of craft cocktails. The craft cocktail world wasn't with us yet. And so when you look at the things that were winning contests at the time, it's things like 2 scoops of vanilla ice cream and orgeat and, you know, soda and whipped cream and simple syrup. So it's just like a ton of sugar. They really didn't represent cocktails in the way we think of them now. So that's where it gets its bad reputation. But things have been changing now. And sometimes bartenders point out that they don't like the word mocktail because mock means both fake and mock also means to make fun of. And so they want to put their guests first and they don't like that word. I personally don't, I don't correct anyone when they say if they want to call it a mocktail, if that's what you want to call it, like have fun, it's great. I prefer zero proof, and sometimes bartenders use spirit free or temperance. I think everything's fine. The last thing I'll say about mocktail is that it's very much of a time and place, in the same way that disco music represents a specific era and a specific production values. But disco as electronic dance music has never left. It's always been with us. It just has changed style and it's changed production values. We call it different things now. We might call it house or techno or electronica, but it's still there. And so the mocktail in the same way has always been with us. It has just always changed names and changed the personality in some way, and certainly has changed production values.
And in your research for your book, you traveled the world, really, and it seems like there's been this boom in interest in zero-proof drinks, but also in the creativity that people are putting into creating them. What is driving this?
Well, you know, almost every great bartender now is an expert in everything, right? So every bartender now is a whiskey expert. They are a mezcal expert. They can talk to you everything about tequila and production that goes into very specific spirits. And so the non-alcoholic drink really represents like the vanguard of a new way of them to flex. And it's very culinary inspired. It allows them to do a lot of things. A metaphor I use sometimes is if you have a French trained chef and you ask them to make you something vegan, they're not gonna not make you something great. They're just, you know, not gonna use dairy or beef, right? And a really talented bartender is the same way. If you ask them to make them something non-alcoholic, they're still gonna have all their tools, all their bag of tricks, and they're still gonna come up with something that's very exciting. And so for a lot of bartenders, they see this as a new challenge, a way to sort of show off their flavor combinations and their different techniques. You just can't use booze, but you're still gonna get something that's very thoughtful and carefully crafted.
Now, Wisconsin has a pretty big drinking culture, and I've heard from people over the years, you know, you feel weird when you're in the group of people drinking alcohol and you're the one not drinking. I think that might be changing some. Can you talk about that kind of inclusive part of providing these delicious non-alcoholic beverages for people? They get to play, they get to join in and not be the odd one out.
Absolutely. You know, that theme, that the idea of like, I don't want to drink, but then I don't want to be the weird one left out. That goes back, honestly, centuries, right? Like in my research, that goes all the way back to the colonies, and we see it a lot in Prohibition and certainly in the 1950s. Just a quick story. I saw this news article from the 1960s from Chicago, where a bartender said that during these, like the Mad Men era, executives would come up and, you know, pay the bartender a ton of money ahead of time to fill a vodka bottle with water so that they would just get poured water all night because they didn't want to have to, they couldn't drink and socialize and do their jobs. So this anxiety about still having to be social but not be singled out has been with us for a long time. And the popularity of these new products and the popularity of the non-alcoholic space is the fact that the companies and bartenders and consumers are finally recognizing that it's okay not to drink, that you don't have to feel weird, and like there's ways to make people comfortable. And one of the interesting ways is that you create a cocktail that looks the same, right? That's going to be made with a really great ingredients. It's going to be presented in a great glass. It's not going to be a pint glass, you know, that just looks like water. It's not going to be, you know, just a clear, it might be clear, but it doesn't have to look boring. It doesn't have to look like everyone has, you know, their wonderful martini glasses and you're the one holding just like a pint glass of water. That's what we're trying to get away from. In the same way, I'll add that, you know, years ago, friends who are vegetarian or vegan, you know, they would be giving a hard time when they went to restaurants. You know, the kitchen would be like, I don't know, do you want carrots? Like people would be giving a hard time if they wanted something that was vegan. But now that's not the way anymore. Now it's accepted, or it's expected, I should say, that you're going to have to have multiple options for people with vegan or vegetarian preferences. I would say that we're going to see the same thing with non-alcoholic drinks. It's not there yet, but that's where it's going.
It's Food Friday. We are making some non-alcoholic cocktails. Alva Ramirez is with us, author of the book Zero Proof, 90 non-alcoholic recipes for mindful drinking. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with non-alcoholic cocktails. If you have one you like, if you've encountered one out in the wild, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in River Falls. Randy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Great subject today. I'm listening intently because I don't drink a lot anymore. I'm a little bit older. I did plenty of drinking when I was young. Never drank and drove, so I did a lot of designated driving, and I still do that. So, but I've at home now been experimenting with some mock drinks, different versions of Bloody Marys, ice cream drinks, sour drinks. I've really kind of really enjoyed, but you know, really looking at all kinds of different ingredients and things, and really enthused about all the media on going to these different drinks.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Well, let's start to get practical. He mentioned that Bloody Mary territory, Alva. What kind of things have you encountered out there as you talk to bartenders about how they make a good non-alcoholic Bloody Mary style drink?
You know, what's funny is that in my research, there's actually an article that I found in a women's magazine that, to modern eyes, to our eyes, is a Bloody Mary recipe. And it was originally in this particular magazine. It was published as a non-alcoholic drink because it was published during Prohibition. And this predates what we consider to be the birth of the Bloody Mary at the King Cole Bar in New York a few years later. So actually, the Bloody Mary was always non-alcoholic. But what I love about this idea of the Bloody Mary and Randy's comment is this idea of savory, because sometimes people assume, quite rightly, that a lot of non-alcoholic drinks they're made with fresh juices, they're sweet, and they are. Some can be, absolutely. But there's really a lot of room to play with this idea of savory. Bitter is actually really great, because things that are savory and bitter force you to slow down and force you to sip. You're not going to drink it all at once, although that's nice too. But a savory complex drink with a lot of layers will kind of allow you to kind of really enjoy that moment. So you can do a lot with the first thing if someone were to say, oh, you know, how can I make a really great Bloody Mary? I would say, think of it like, you know, it's cooking, right? It's culinary. Think about things like dehydrated mushrooms that you would let steep for a really long time. So that you're making a really kind of dense mushroom tea, and then you're using that as the base to begin something like a Bloody Mary. There's a Will Wyatt who used to be at Love Madison Park and now is at Mr. Paradise in New York, gave me a really wonderful recipe for the book where he makes a mushroom tea. He also makes a dashi with clarified tomato. So you can do a lot of things where, even if you have the Bloody Mary, if you try running it through like coffee filters, for example, and you take the pulp out and you get something that's just like very, very clear, you're going to get something that's going to remind you a little bit of a savory martini. That can be really, really fun. You can do a lot with that.
Thanks a lot for that call. And that reminds me, speaking of savory type drinks, you shared a couple of recipes with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. The Medina Night. Now, this is a carrot juice based drink. Can you tell us about this one?
Yes. One second. I'm pulling up on the page right now. Just so I can have it correct. So this came from Sam Johnson at Death & Co., which is if you know New York City, you know bars. Death & Co. is one of the top bars in New York City, and they actually have other locations as well. So this one completely caught me off guard when he made it. It's wonderfully vibrant. You know, if you've had fresh carrot juice, you know that it has this like really beautiful sweetness and earthiness to it. So it does catch you off guard. This is one of those drinks where you look at the ingredients and you recognize everything. You say, okay, it has carrot juice, has fresh lemon juice, has ginger syrup, a little bit of orange juice and honey, and you go, oh, I know all those flavors. But when you put it together and you shake it up, you kind of go, oh, I wasn't expecting that. And so what's really great about this drink is that it has a bit of complexity to it. It comes together really easily, but the carrot juice, you know, gives it this lovely earthiness and a gorgeous color. You know, orange juice is giving you a little bit of sweetness. Ginger is going to give you a little bit of heat, and honey, of course, is sweet. It's a really wonderful brunch drink. I discovered it because he made it during my friend's, baby shower. Sorry, I forgot what it's called for a second. He made it during my friend's baby shower, and it was an absolute hit.
Talking to Alva Ramirez, wine and spirits writer, author of the book Zero Proof. On this edition of Food Friday, she's serving up advice for making great non-alcoholic cocktails for your next happy hour or baby shower. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite mixed drink when you're not drinking alcohol, whether you never drink it or you want? I do this a lot. I want a cocktail. I want booze right now. I like having something that meets that category, doesn't have the alcohol in it. If you have a favorite one, if you've encountered great ones at restaurants or bars or terrible ones at restaurants or bars, we want to hear about it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking with Alva Ramirez, author of Zero Proof, 90 non-alcoholic recipes for mindful drinking. We're mixing up some great non-alcoholic cocktails. Whether you call it a mocktail or zero proof or spirit-free, it's all about making a great mixed drink without alcohol. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to mad scientist this at home like I do sometimes? What have you come up with? What are some of your hits and misses? What makes you want to drink non-alcoholic cocktails? I get it. Why do you do it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Alva, a few of our commenters on Facebook have brought up part of the social side of this. Brandy writes, when I didn't order a drink, people used to ask if I was pregnant, which was really hard because I had losses. This is before I could do in vitro fertilization. But now it's no big deal. And you hammer this point home, Alva, in your book. If people say, hey, yeah, I don't want an alcoholic drink, we don't need to interrogate them as to why, right?
Absolutely. And you never have to explain yourself in the same way that we never, you know, you don't go out with your vegetarian friends and pressure them to eat chicken. Like we don't do that anymore. And so I'm hoping that the same care comes to the non-alcoholic drink. And I sort of feel that pain, and you know, of being... there's an assumption that something's wrong. And, you know, that really kind of dates back to that's very ingrained. It goes back to the idea of why we drink and what happens when we drink. It's a lot of things. This is not a new thing. This goes back, honestly, centuries. If you look at drinking culture and people are fearful of things that are others. If you, everyone's drinking and you're not, it's suspicious, even if they don't come out and say that. And so ideally we're going to get past that someday. But the few ways around that is to, you can order drinks now and you can look at the menu, and there's usually a lot of restaurants will have a menu where they will have non-alcoholic drinks highlighted. And when you order this, you'll get a pretty drink in a pretty glass, and then you don't stand out. Right. That's the ideal, that you can look across the room and you don't have to, it looks like everyone's holding pretty cocktails and you can't tell what's what. That's the point that we're going to get to. You know, we're getting there. Sometimes we still have bumps in the road, but I'm hoping to get there. And I'm hoping that a lot of this comes from training, I'll say. Bartenders are great, but sometimes even bartenders will make that assumption, or waiters, you know, if you ask, oh, I'm not drinking that, they'll say, oh, what's wrong? Like, why not? I haven't gotten that, but my friends have gotten that and told me about it. And it's, especially if you're a woman, it feels a little bit invasive. So I also hope that this is not just based, you know, the burden is not just on the consumer. I'm hoping that there's a lot of training that happens in hospitality where they're training the staff to not make assumptions about why someone doesn't want to drink.
We also heard from Carol on Facebook, who writes, I do not drink alcohol by choice. I've never had any problems in ordering drinks. Last week, I had a refreshing lemonade, orange juice, and Sprite beverage, while others had tequila in theirs. All right, more power to you, Carol. But I got to say, Alva, I generally want not a mixed drink minus the alcohol. I want something to fulfill some of the, I guess, the burn, some of the bitter in some cases. I use bitters, which has a tiny bit of booze. You're using a couple drops there. Sometimes a little iced tea gives that like a bitter base. You mentioned that steeping the mushrooms. What are some of the other things that people do to fill a little bit of that void when you take alcohol out of that mixed drink?
You know, while I was writing this book right before the boom in the brands, the non-alcoholic brands happened. So my book has a lot of original recipes. It doesn't have a lot of products, but I was able to put some products in there. And if I had written the book a year after, it would have changed. So to answer your question in one way, there's a whole new, like just so many new brands that can really help with that. And that really take that idea of like, oh, when we drink, we do like that burn. And there's just really fantastic products. Ritual Zero Proof, which is based out of Chicago, is fantastic. And Marcus, the CEO, designed that when his wife was pregnant and he wanted to like not drink in solidarity with her. And as he was mixing things up, he was like, no, I want this burn. And so Ritual has like they come through it with a little bit of depending on the they have different flavors, but they'll do things like add pepper, for example, to give you that burn. So there's Ritual's great, C-Lip is great. And in terms of bitterness, there's these non-alcoholic sodas. There's so many now of these bitter Amaro sodas. They're in the style of the Italian Amaro sodas that you see in Europe. The Casamara Club, which is based out of Brooklyn, they are absolutely fantastic. And they really have a complex bitter profile that is immensely satisfying, that you don't miss the alcohol in that, because it has layers. And that's really the key to a really good cocktail, like even just a regular cocktail, a traditional, let's just talk about a traditional like old fashioned, for example. We like that because when we drink it, it has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a finish. And it sits with you for a long time. And so for a long time, the non-alcoholic drink, when it was made with just juice, it's just one note. There's not much to it. And once you drink it, it's gone. And so with these non-alcoholic brands, a lot of these new liqueurs, and like I said, these sparkling sodas, they're really thinking about what's satisfying in a drink. And what's satisfying in a drink is a beginning, middle, and end, and a finish. And so that's one way of approximating that sort of pleasure we get from having, say, whiskey. It's to have something that lingers longer than that last sip.
Now, you have 90 recipes in this book. I'm sure you've tried many more. Are there one or two non-alcoholic cocktails, Elva, that have become just part of your regular life that you just loved so much that they're your thing now?
There is one. It's not on the list here, but there's actually the ones that you're listing on your website are absolutely fantastic. I'd love to talk about the Grove and Tonic, but the one I remember that I was talking about was so simple. It was came from my friend at Les Syndicats, which is one of the top bars in Paris, and it's so simple. It's basically you steep lemon verbena and chamomile, and no, sorry, lemon verbena and lavender overnight. Just let it sit with some water and some sugar. You strain out the solids after the fact. So then you basically have this like sweet cordial. And then we add tonic to it and C-Lip. No, we add kombucha. So we add kombucha and some lemon juice, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Every time I have a party, I make it. It's more or less three steps. It's shocking how delicious it is. It's in my book. But the one that's on the website right now is called Grove and Tonic. And this is a really pretty one because the secret to this one is that you're making rose ice cubes. So the drink is going to be pink, and then it's going to change color as you have these pink, like these rose, they're basically made with peach tea. So you basically make tea and then you let it freeze. And then when you make your drink and put it all together, you're going to put the ice cubes in the drink, and everything's going to change color over time.
That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to our Food Friday guest, Elva Ramirez, author of the book Zero Proof. Find that recipe she was just talking about and another one, too, for this carrot-based drink at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can keep sharing your non-alcoholic cocktail stories, preferences, hits and misses over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, advice is everywhere, but it's not all good. We talk about how to tell if the advice you're getting, whether it's from friends, parents, strangers on the internet, is good or should be ignored. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsin pilot who will be making a homecoming at this weekend's Milwaukee Air and Water Show.
The U.S. Navy Blue Angels may be the most recognizable group of performing aviators in the world. Flying at up to 60 air shows in North America each year, the F-18 pilots who make up this unit are among the best of the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps. One of the current Blue Angels is a Wisconsin native, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle, who grew up in Madison. Dusty Weiss got to know Stangle while flying with the Blue Angels.
We're cruising along over the Gulf of Mexico at about 500 miles an hour in an F-18 Super Hornet fighter jet. And in the pilot seat in front of me, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle wants to talk football.
Dusty, are you a Packers fan?
Oh my God, yes.
Okay, cool. My wife's a Vikings fan, so we had a rough weekend, but we're working through it, obviously.
Proof that you could take the boy out of Wisconsin, make him an elite naval aviator, and give him the assignment this year of Blue Angel number 6. But you can't take the Wisconsin out of the boy.
Like, I grew up in Madison. I went to Madison West. I am just a person who decided one day that I'm going to follow my passion and try to be the best pilot I can be.
Stengel's journey began 15 years ago. Inspired by a class that he took with Madison pilot Diane Ballwig, he studied aviation at the University of North Dakota and then joined the U.S. Navy. In flight school, he was drawn to the raw power and majesty of flying F-18 fighter jets launched off of carriers at sea.
It's awesome. You could be having the worst day, and as soon as you get shot off the front end, it changes your outlook, and you're just flying, you know?
But flying F-18s is one of the most sought-after roles in the Navy. Stangle says the training and competition were intense. But a decade later, his drive and determination have now earned him a coveted assignment as one of only 260 Blue Angels pilots in history. I wanted to understand just how demanding his job is.
All right, Dusty.
That is why I found myself strapped snugly into the F-18 passenger seat behind Stangle at Blue Angels headquarters in Pensacola.
First leg max afterburner.
Liftoff is like a rocket launch. And over the next hour, Stangle subjects me to maneuvers with names like the Split S and the Half Cuban 8.
This is incredible!
But the real eye-openers are the high-G turns, where you experience 6 or 7 times the normal force of gravity. If you don't flex every muscle in your legs and core and breathe just right, the inertia can pull all the blood from your brain and cause you to black out.
All right, we're coming to the right for 6 Gs. Ready, hit it.
The Gs don't come on gradually.
There's 6.
It feels like I'm being hit by 1,000 pounds of sandbags all at once.
We're rolling out. All right, brother, how you feeling?
Oh, man, that was a lot. Started graying out a little bit, but do you get gray during that? Or are you just like cool as a cucumber?
We're pretty accustomed to pulling these Gs all the time.
It's all I can do just to keep it together. But it is clear that Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle is undeniably in his element here.
Oh, I remember the first time I took off in an F-18. It's a pretty wild sensation.
Are you going to be spoiled for the rest of your life?
You know, there's that distinct possibility that just kind of reminds me to take every day, give it 100%, and not take anything for granted. It's a privilege to be working with such incredible people who are so dedicated to giving their all every day. Being able to stand a part of the Blue Angel team is just a true blessing.
For 60 precious minutes, I have the opportunity to experience exactly what Stangle is talking about. Sure, I end up drenched in sweat and panting for breath.
Just like that, we're back on solid ground.
But Stangle's ability to perform under those conditions with a chuckle and a grin leaves me with a profound respect for the incredible drive and athleticism that it takes to fly the F-18. And he says being able to showcase that singular talent for the first time over his home state of Wisconsin is a special experience.
Yeah, it's a real treat flying over a city that was a big part of my childhood. Coming home and seeing the places that I went to growing up, it kind of means a lot, you know? You never forget where you come from.
A return to his roots for a proud Wisconsinite who earned his wings.
Dusty Weiss is host and producer of the Lead Balloon Podcast, and he's based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle and the rest of the Blue Angels will perform at the Milwaukee Air and Water Show on July 22nd and 23rd. Now it's easy to find advice in this world. Friends and family, randos on the internet, everyone can be a source of advice, even if you didn't ask for it. So how are we supposed to know if someone's opinion, whether it's a professional opinion or an unsolicited one, is actually worth listening to? Advice giving and taking is an age-old pastime. Historians say advice columns have been around for at least 300 years. Our next guest interviewed advice-giving experts to get some advice about how to figure out what advice to take and what to trash. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's the best advice you've ever gotten? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten? Do you try to share advice with other people? When and where and when do you just clam up and listen? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allie Volpe is a senior reporter at Vox. Allie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you to seek advice about advice for your piece, Allie?
Yeah, it's funny. It is a little meta. A lot of what I cover does require me reaching out to experts and getting their advice on a variety of topics. And a workplace discussion kind of veered down this topic of like, well, what advice is good advice? And so I was kind of working with the working headline of advice about advice. So I figure, you know, if we are doling it out, we might as well teach people what advice to take and what to ditch.
Now, in general, there have been some studies on this, and it sounds like getting advice, if we do it right, it can help us make better decisions. What do we know?
Right. Like we all know what we know and we don't know what we don't know. We have our biases. We have our blinders up to certain things. There was studies that actually showed if you got advice from a sports fan who was a fan of a team you weren't rooting for, you made a better bet on how the game would resolve if you, you know, took their advice instead of just going with your gut, hoping that your preferred team would win. So taking advice does help us make better decisions, but we're not very good at taking that advice, even if we've asked for it ourselves, research shows.
How do we make sure we're getting advice that might actually confront our blind spots as opposed to so-and-so thinks, we don't think this out loud probably, but so-and-so thinks like I do, they'll back me up in this decision I'm making, whether it's right or not. How do we make sure we're getting a positive committee, not a yes men kind of committee?
Right. I think it's important to think about who's giving the advice. Is it somebody who has expertise in the area we're looking for advice in? I maybe wouldn't go to my best friend for legal advice if they do not have that sort of expertise. So I think it's important to look at where that advice is coming from, because maybe oftentimes a close friend or a family member might just be saying what they think we want to hear and instead of what we actually need to hear.
Now, if we don't want to hear advice, how can we put ourselves or the advice that's going to help us? How do we put ourselves in a mindset to say, OK, this isn't what I wanted to hear. Maybe I need to take it seriously, though.
So what I found interesting from reporting this piece is sometimes we do get that advice that is like, I don't want to do this. This feels hard. This feels difficult. But sometimes that's what we need to do. I found it interesting that people often take advice when it is it aligns with our life, it addresses a problem, and it's feasible to achieve, and it doesn't have any major consequences or side effects. So sometimes good advice just comes in bad packages. Like sometimes a parent might tell us advice in a condescending manner, or advice might feel that it is too difficult. But sometimes we just need to take a step back and think about it. That bit of advice that we maybe thought was too hard or didn't align with our lives maybe is the thing we should do. I talked to an advice columnist who talked about someone who wrote in asking for advice on whether to ask out somebody who they had a crush on. And so the hard thing to do would to give the advice of yes, ask out that person. That is a vulnerable thing that sometimes might give us butterflies. It might feel bad, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes the hard thing or the thing that gives us the negative reaction is the right thing to do.
We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media, Aaron Cook, one of our HR people, says the first thing I always try to do is filter the advice through several lenses. Is this advice helpful or hurtful? The result of knowledge and experience versus bias. Is it a judgment or an actual critique on any sort of content? Finally, I consider where the advice is coming from and where I stand in relation to it. Who's the expert? Is this something creative or emotional? A long line of filters there for advice. Allie, Aaron is clearly thinking about ways to figure out what advice is good or not. What did you hear from experts when it came to evaluating advice in those ways?
Yeah, definitely the panel of getting a lot of different opinions was something that experts definitely sang the praises of. Getting a number of different viewpoints helps us to consider all angles that we maybe didn't consider. But then there comes a point where if you are just asking dozens and dozens of people, maybe you haven't really thought about what you actually want. So it is helpful if you can get a clear consensus from a panel of a handful of people. But if you feel the need to keep asking people, you probably just don't know what you want.
We're talking about how to tell if we're getting good or bad advice with Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you tell if you're getting good advice or bad advice? Any advice you regret taking or not taking in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about sorting out good advice from bad with Allie Volpe. She's a senior reporter. She wrote about this at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellen is with us in Peterborough. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, this one is kind of odd. I was in a very intense year-long program at Milwaukee Mental Health Complex. I received very good care, and I had a psychiatrist who saw me every week. At the end of that year, his last advice to me was, watch those left turns, Ellen. And as a person who drives a lot, I have found that he was right. But I think it's hilarious that after that, you know, that was his advice.
I love it, Ellen. I thank you for sharing that, Allie. I like that in part because, okay, we've been through this long experience, but here's some really, I don't know, grounding, very practical advice that's going to help anybody who, in this case, anybody who drives.
Right. Sometimes the most practical thing is the best thing to do. And the advice that sort of takes us by surprise, I find the most memorable and that I will actually use.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ellen, at 800-642-1234. Yeah, what I hope my kids take away from growing up in my house is careful on the steps, because stairs are great, but yeah, they may be dangerous if you're not careful on them. Now, looking back at the experts you talked to, Allie, sometimes we offer advice when it isn't really being solicited. How can we be careful not to give that unwanted advice?
Right. And I am so guilty of this sometimes. Sometimes all people want is just to vent. They don't want advice. And I found it's actually just really easy to ask somebody straight up, do you want advice or do you just want me to listen? And no one is ever really offended by that. And oftentimes people just want you to listen. And so I make sure when I'm about to vent to a friend or get their advice, I'll often preface it with, oh, I really want your advice on this, or can I tell you about something? And I think that sort of guides the conversation so you're not getting unsolicited advice.
We heard from Susan in Suamico. She says the best advice she was ever given was from her father when she was pregnant with her first. She said the advice was the best thing to spend on your child is time. Oh, I like that. So that's an example of someone with a specific bit of experience. It was her dad talking about child raising. I don't know. Are there good general kinds of advice that we can reach out to and get that kind of wisdom?
I love that bit of advice. Something an expert told me that really stuck out to me was somebody who's in the quote unquote messy middle of an experience often has really good insight, even though they might feel that they don't. So a parent who maybe has toddlers and they're in the middle of it is better suited to give advice about parenting than maybe someone who's an empty nester, because you are the one who's actually experiencing it every day.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Well, to follow up on an earlier comment, UPS used to instruct their drivers to make 3 right turns on a block instead of taking a left to prevent accidents. But my advice, I'm not sure if it was a line in a movie or on a TV show or something from one of my grandfathers or an uncle or my dad, but it was in the context of an Italian restaurant, and it was simply, don't fill up on bread.
I love it, Tom. And have you lived by this rule?
Actually, I've probably strayed from it, but I think that when I think of it, it means the main course is still coming.
Excellent. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. We're asking for your best or worst advice ever given or received. Allie Volpe wrote about how we evaluate advice we get. She's a senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our own Larry Mueller, host of the Larry Mueller Show here at Wisconsin Public Radio, told us, my high school guidance counselor told me I should not attend UW-Madison, but find a smaller school where I'd have a better chance to succeed. I asked my dad about it, and he said I should go where I want, and if I failed, I could try another school. So Larry says I went to UW-Madison, succeeded, eventually became a full professor at UW, and had a pretty successful radio career on campus, I would add, Larry. Allie, when we're making a big, or at least what feels at the time, like a huge life decision, like where should I go to college or what job should I seek or whatever, what did you learn from the people you interviewed about how to seek out useful advice?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that we tend to favor advisors who are more confident, but those people might not always be the most accurate. So I think it's important to get diverse points of view. Like, we tend to seek out people who are similar to us. So finding people who have a different experience than we do in getting advice can often help lead us in the right direction. So it's funny that the guidance counselor, you know, said one thing, dad said another thing. And so you kind of just take the average of those two bits of advice, which experts say is actually a good way to go.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ganado is with us in Milwaukee. Ganado, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Love to see two media sources that I love combined together. I read Allie's articles as well on Vox all the time. But my piece of advice that I wanted to talk about was when I first started grad school, I was not doing super hot because I had just moved to Milwaukee and was starting a new job, and so it wasn't my primary focus in life. I had asked one of my friends who was recently in grad school, like, hey, should I stay with the course or drop it? He suggested that I stay, which not a very good decision because GPA requirements in grad school are very different from undergrad. So I ended up my first semester in academic probation. So, funny story there. I think we both lacked some context, but just wanted to share that.
Well, I hope things got better.
They did. I did graduate, and things turned out fine in the end.
Yay. Okay. Glad to hear that part of it. But, Allie, I think sometimes there's an instinct to say when you give advice, stick to it. Power through. Don't give up. And sometimes giving up, as in the case of Ganado's class, might be the right advice.
Right. And I think that comes back to sort of the criteria that good advice fulfills, you know, whether it solves a problem, is feasible, and doesn't have any consequences. I would argue, you know, spending a lot of money on something that, you know, you might not achieve at is a pretty big consequence or side effect. And therefore that advice maybe isn't the best.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Now, one expert told you, this is in like broadening horizons here, don't just consider advice from people who have succeeded, right? Because that seems obvious. Seek out people maybe in similar situations who have failed in one way or another. Why is that helpful?
Yeah, one expert gave an example of someone who has been divorced and getting marriage advice from them. They can kind of see the other side. They can see where things have gone wrong, maybe things that they would have done differently. Not to say that we should only be seeking advice from people who have failed something, but they have a unique perspective on, you know, things that didn't go right. That same expert also said getting advice from somebody who, you know, is in the middle of something is really helpful as well. Like somebody who's maybe like in the middle of training for a marathon, but they are like exhausted by it. But giving advice to someone who is a little bit less experienced can help like revive them a little bit and get them excited and remind them why they're doing it.
I want to talk about a source of advice that previous generations weren't lucky enough to have access to, random people on the internet. What did experts say about the advice of, you know, the whole planet online?
Yeah, everyone loves to give advice online. And I think it comes down to just some basic media literacy tips. You know, anyone can post a TikTok telling you how to wake up earlier in the morning. And you might feel susceptible to that. Like, yeah, I can achieve so much more if I got up early. But one, you need to think about, like, do you actually want that advice? Or are you just kind of consuming it passively and think that's something that you might need for your life, but it doesn't actually fit in with your schedule? Something else is like that any person online can put up a video, but what is their credentials? What is their expertise? My colleague, Rebecca Jennings, did this great piece about online influencers posting online courses to their YouTube pages, or, you know, getting people to pay money for online courses that they have set up themselves. So do they have any expertise in that? I don't know. Are they just looking to get money? Probably. So if a person is, you know, saying something or doing something to solicit some sort of reaction from somebody, whether that is to be angry or to give them money, I would be skeptical of their advice.
It's a good place to leave it. Allie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. She talked to us about her recent article, How to Tell When You're Getting Good Advice. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.